Ani, and welcome to Bomsida, an Aboriginal news magazine program that features news, current affairs, a focus on community and culture, spotlights on entertainment and great tunes, and every flavor from Aboriginal artists. I'm your host, Jennifer Ashwasage. A family in Saskatchewan is desperately waiting to hear if the body of a family member will come home from Nigeria. The results of a survey by the Canadian Council for Aboriginal Business are in, and the outlook is good for Aboriginal business owners and entrepreneurs in the country. And there's something different about an electronic billboard near the Burrard Street Bridge in Vancouver. It's the Digital Natives Public Art Project. The first Aboriginal dual credit university program has been deemed a success in Ontario, and Antigone, an Aboriginal adapted play based on the Greek tragedy, went on despite a ban by Chief and Council at Poundmaker First Nation. All these stories plus great tunes coming your way right after the news. Here's International Aboriginal News. Marcia Sisiquesis lies awake at night wondering if her sister's body is decomposing. Her sister is Deborah Merpine, whose remains are in a funeral home in Nigeria. The family has been waiting since March 24th on word when the body will be transported home to Saskatchewan. Sisiquesis says the family is waiting to hear from the Canadian Embassy about the next of kin rights as well. She says her new brother-in-law has not been available for contact.
Marcia has been unavailable, and hasn't been communicating with neither the family nor the embassy, and I'm not certain about the funeral home if he's been talking with them. But the thing is that we, as the family, consider ourselves to be the next of kin, and we should have the rights as to make the arrangements.
The family received the death certificate April 6th, indicating Deborah Pine died of blood poisoning. Sisiquesis says for now, all the family can do is wait.
We sit and wait. We sit and wait while the embassy negotiates on our behalf to... In Nigeria, the Canadian Embassy, there's a representative there that is coordinating or working with the funeral home, the Nigerian authorities, and Martin to be able to bring Debbie home.
In an email, the Department of Foreign Affairs and International Trade Canada says it's aware of the death of a Canadian citizen in Nigeria, and consular officials in Nigeria and in Ottawa are providing consular assistance to her family, plus they say the Privacy Act prevents the department from releasing additional details. Nunavut residents are worried about the nuclear reactor disaster in Japan as they contemplate a proposed uranium mine. A meeting was held March 31st in Baker Lake to discuss the proposed $1.5 billion uranium mine. CTV News reports the residents have been asking whether they want uranium mining on their land for years. Halfway through the meeting, an elderly Inuit man asked why people in Japan are so scared about the nuclear issues. Community members have been talking about the disaster in Japan, which has also added more urgency to community discussions about the proposed uranium mine. And CTV also reports that the debate in Baker Lake was fairly evenly split between those who favor it and those who fear it. First Nation organizations are putting their election priorities forward and encouraging First Nation citizens to participate in the federal election. The Anishinaabeg Nation has launched its First People's Vote campaign. The campaign is to encourage First Nations people to vote. And according to the Anishinaabeg Nation, only 41% of First Nations voted in the 2008 election. The Anishinaabeg Nation also maintains there are 85 potential swing ridings with First Nations influence in Canada. Meantime, the Assembly of First Nations has released its list of election platform priorities. The AFN's priorities includes an affirmation enabling First Nations governments, implementing treaties and agreements, and settling claims. Investing in First Nations education is another priority, as are support for economic development and addressing First Nations health, which also includes addressing water issues. An election questionnaire for voters to post to the candidates in their ridings is also posted on the AFN website. Meanwhile, the interim leader of the First People's Party of Canada says Canada should abolish the Senate and replace it with a House of Parliament filled with elected Aboriginal representatives. William Morin also told Straight.com that Native Studies classes should be made compulsory in high schools and universities across the country. Morin also said that Aboriginal people must be included in all levels of government in Canada. The FNFP is a relatively new party in Canada and was founded in 2005. And according to its website, the party's mandate includes promoting economic growth, fighting poverty, building social programs in health, education, and culture, as well as respecting and representing Canadians. 15 First Nation groups in BC are supporting a natural gas pipeline project. LDNews.net reports Pacific Trails Pipelines is the developer of a proposed 463-kilometer natural gas pipeline that will stretch from Summit Lake close to Prince George to Kitimat. First Nation stakeholders with traditional territories in the pipeline's path have signed on to support the Pacific Trails Pipeline project. A 2009 signed agreement gives the 15 First Nations a combined 30% ownership in the project. The Canadian Council for Aboriginal Business has released its research findings. CCAB recently completed a survey of more than 1,000 Aboriginal business owners and entrepreneurs across the country. The organization wanted to look at business goals and strategies and factors contributing to their growth. Clint Davis is the president and CEO of CCAB. He says the key findings were a surprise.
Well, the key findings were rather interesting. So a couple of things. First of all, were Aboriginal businesses are certainly experiencing some significant growth over the span of 5 years. We've noticed that Aboriginal businesses were growing at a rate 5 times faster than the non-Aboriginal population. The second thing that we saw was over 60% actually reported profits in 2010. With about one-third increasing revenues over that same period of time. And that's quite something, considering that we were just getting out of one of the most significant economic downturns that the world has seen in modern times.
Davis adds Aboriginal business owners were also optimistic about their future, and 70% of those surveyed indicated anticipated revenue growth over the next few years. The Aboriginal Dual Credit Pilot Program at Laurentian University hopes to expand after a successful year. It's hoped the program will increase Aboriginal retention and graduation rates. The pilot project offered two courses, business and Native social welfare. Vanessa Lewis is 16 years old, and she participated in the dual credit program and took both courses for 8 credits in high school and university. Lewis says the program was good for her.
The program has helped me with multiple things, whether it's patience with dealing with different people or learning with different people, different aspects of why they are not succeeding in life as others are. And for the business program, my professor was amazing. Jean-Charles Cachon, he made sure that we learned everything possible and were left with no questions. And in the end, it was very successful, and we presented our business programs.
Dean of the Faculty of Management, Peter Luke, says the pilot program has been deemed a success. He says it's the only dual credit program for a university, as a number of colleges in Canada already have similar programs. Although Luke says the program was successful this year, he's hoping for more community support next year.
We need to time it better next time as a pilot project, and by the time we got some of the people with it, local business people, through my connection with the Chamber of Commerce. So possibly next year, we need to do a better job in terms of the timing of it for the second cohort, so that not only that getting people who are willing, but to allow them to actually do it from a timing perspective. So it will be done.
Luke says the business course had the support of the Paul Martin Aboriginal Education Initiative. The project wrapped up in late January. The show must go on, the saying goes, and it did in Poundmaker First Nation, despite a motion from the band council banning the play Antigone. The play is an Aboriginal adaptation of the classic Greek tragedy, which is set on a contemporary First Nation ruled by a corrupt chief. And, according to Post Media News, Poundmaker Chief Dwayne Antoine and two other members of council voted to ban the performance, saying it was political propaganda against the chief. Deanne Cassio-Keo is the playwright of the modern version and also a member of Poundmaker First Nation. She says the play was performed in the community despite the ban and was performed in the school gym with the assistance of one counselor. Cassio Keo says she hasn't received any direct criticism for putting on the play.
I haven't received any kind of backlash as of yet. However, community members are, because of the repercussions that happens within communities when you voice out or have, you know, when you voice out against leadership, there are repercussions that happen. But I don't rely, those are people who are scared, community members that are scared that rely on the reserve, I guess. And I don't have to rely on the reserve at all. I don't work there. I just live there.
Kasokio adds there's a good message in the play that First Nations people need to look at governance structures within the Indian Act and reconsider them. There's something different about an electronic billboard near the Burrard Street Bridge in Vancouver. There's messages like, First Nations, we are not a stereotype, not gone, not lost, still connected. Or, Riot 1492. It's a public arts project called Digital Natives. Simon Fraser University English professor Clint Burnham came up with the idea and is the co-curator of the project. Burnham says Twitter-like messages are posted on the billboard near the bridge. He says the project includes a number of artists from around the country.
We curated we solicited contributions from 30 writers and artists, Native and non-Native, from around North America. And so some of the messages are about the bridge itself or about its location. Some of them are about the sign itself is on Squamish territory. So a lot of them are about First Nations issues and issues of language and so on.
Burnham says it's interesting that some of the messages have been censored by Astral Media, which owns the billboard. The project began April 5th and runs until April 30th. The project is funded by the City of Vancouver for its 125th anniversary. You can see the rolling tweets on the Digital Natives blog at digitalnatives.othersites.ca. And that's your National Aboriginal News. Was Women's Lament by Jenny Lazon. Marcia Sisaquasis lies awake at night wondering if her sister's body is decomposing. And if it's decomposing, She wonders how fast it's decomposing. She wonders if the remains of her sister, Deborah Marie Pine, will even come home so that the family can have closure and say goodbye. Her sister died in Nigeria March 24th, and Marcia spoke with Bomsda on April 6th.
We sit and wait, and we sit and wait while the embassy negotiates on our behalf. In Nigeria, the Canadian embassy, there's a representative there that is coordinating or working with the funeral home, the Nigerian authorities, and Martin to be able to bring Debbie home.
Okay, and can you tell us what happened with Debbie?
Based on her death certificate, which was just received yesterday, we understand it. I don't even know how to say that word, septical loss. Or I don't know what it is. It's a blood disease. I mean, a blood poisoning, as we found out online, and so that's the only information we have. But the death certificate has that. I don't have it in front of me, but yeah, it's extreme gas loss of gas something. There's a couple causes of, it's listed on her death certificate as a couple causes, so. And she passed away on the 24th of March, and based on the funeral home information, her body was embalmed by March 29th, and we haven't, it says right on that, from the funeral home, was ready for transport out of Nigeria.
Is there any other organizations that are helping you with this? And has there been other delays in this process?
The community of Beardies. The community of Beardies pulled together with a lot of donations and food and support. And other than that, I've contacted an MP. I'm thinking of going to the ombudsman today. I'm not really sure. Could our political authorities be able to talk to the Nigerian authorities? Because apparently that's where our letter of request went in yesterday, to have the family consent. And we're actually claiming that the next of kin rights are ours. We have some supporting documentation that prove that my sister has been the next of kin throughout her life, and I want to know and I want to see where Debbie has signed, some sort of document claiming that Martin was her next of kin. Was the next of kin, did he sign, the admittance form when she entered the hospital? Is that why he's considered next of kin? Is it the marriage certificate that claims him to the next of kin? But in that country, do they have like a vital statistics where they have to register the marriage? Is there, and that would prove his next of kin. But we as a family feel it's our right to be the next of kin. It's hoping that we could be given that right through the Nigerian authorities to consider us as next of kin. And also to, Martin has been unavailable, and hasn't been communicating with neither the family nor the embassy. And I'm not certain about the funeral home if he's been talking with them. But the thing is that we, as the family, consider ourselves to be the next of kin, and we should have the rights to make the arrangements. I think if we had the next of kin rights, I don't think that the delay would be occurring. Because when she was ready for transport on March 29th, I think it would have followed through that she would have been transported upon receipt of payment to the funeral home. And we as the family took the donations from the community of Beardies and sent what was necessary to the Canadian embassy to make payments to the funeral home so that there would be no delays.
Right.
And as of yet, that payment was made on Friday, and still no news from the funeral home. They, like, all we can do is communicate with Ottawa. I don't have direct communications with Nigeria, the Canadian embassy, or the representative that sits in the Canadian embassy at Nigeria. I haven't talked to her. The only time I did talk to her when Martin was in her office, and they did call us and let us know that she was deceased and that they were going to proceed to go and confirm that Debbie was actually deceased.
That was Marcia Sisakwasis discussing the death of her sister in Nigeria and the trouble the family is having at trying to bring Deborah's remains home. Meanwhile, in an email, the Department of Foreign Affairs and International Trade Canada says it's aware of the death of a Canadian citizen in Nigeria, and consular officials in Nigeria and in Ottawa are providing consular assistance to her family, plus the Privacy Act, they say, prevents the department from releasing additional details. The Canadian Council for Aboriginal Business has released its research findings from its Small Business and Entrepreneur Survey. Clint Davis is the president and CEO of CCAB, and he explains the survey and its findings.
This is a national survey of Aboriginal entrepreneurs conducted in the fall of 2010. Essentially, we surveyed over 1,000 First Nations, Métis, and Inuit small business owners. And effectively what we did do is we focused on a number of different categories of Aboriginal businesses, looking specifically at business goals and objectives, business strategies, profitability and growth, as well as perceived obstacles and sources of financing and non-financial support and advice.
Okay, and why don't we speak a little bit about some of those different categories. And you said you surveyed over 1,000 Aboriginal entrepreneurs, and in what fields were they in?
Well, they came from a number of different industries and so on. The 18% of Aboriginal entrepreneurs represent the construction industry. Around 22% representing the primary industries, those businesses kind of supporting mining, oil and gas, and extraction kind of activities. But over 25% were companies from the knowledge and service, professional service-based industries, different consulting, different professional services and stuff as well.
Okay, and what were some of the key findings?
Well, the key findings were rather interesting. So a couple of things, first of all, were Aboriginal businesses are certainly experiencing some significant growth. Over the span of 5 years, we noticed that Aboriginal businesses were growing at a rate five times faster than the non-Aboriginal population. The second thing that we saw was, over 60% actually reported profits in 2010, with about one-third increasing revenues over that same period of time. That's quite something, considering that we were just getting out of one of the most significant economic downturns that the world has seen in modern times. So even though you've seen other mainstream businesses that certainly stopped operations and went out of business, Aboriginal businesses did very, very well. One other really interesting thing as well was the fact that Aboriginal businesses are very optimistic, certainly about their future. Most, around 70%, anticipate a revenue growth in the next 2 years, and that the same percentage, 71%, were confident that they're going to be running their businesses 5 years from now. So certainly a strong commitment to continue on in their business operations.
And would you know some of the reasons why they were prospering during the economic downturn?
You know, it's I think, quite frankly, that when you look at what their customer base was for Aboriginal businesses, a rather surprising reality was the fact that only a small percentage of Aboriginal businesses provide goods and services to government. And, sometimes when people think of Aboriginal people, they think that government provides them with virtually everything. And in fact, Aboriginal entrepreneurs, they work specifically for, individual customers and different companies as the main base of their of their clientele. So I think that Aboriginal businesses, at the end of the day, were successful simply because they were providing quality goods and services in a highly professional and effective way.
And how useful will this survey be for future planning?
Well, I think there's a number of really great uses for this research. First of all, if you were in government, because we actually looked at the effectiveness of the procurement strategy for Aboriginal business. This is a policy that's been in place since the mid-90s by the federal government, and it sets aside a certain amount of spend specifically by the federal government for Aboriginal business. We've noticed that there wasn't as much uptake around this program as we thought there would be. And while companies have gone through this, Aboriginal companies have gone through the program and feel that the criteria of the program is fine, I think that there is a need for greater awareness and communication on the program, so try and get more and more Aboriginal businesses involved. So I think if you're in government, and you're particularly if you're in government in the West and there's such a high concentration of Aboriginal people, and you're trying to see what can you do in order to fully integrate these individuals and businesses within the economy, I think one way to do it is certainly to be a customer, and you do that by putting forward your own Aboriginal procurement policy or strategy. Manitoba has done that. There's other programs as well that government could be doing in order to provide access to capital. That's still a major obstacle facing Aboriginal entrepreneurs today. So that's one piece. If you're a financial institution, I think this represents a burgeoning market. I think that the fact that you have Aboriginal businesses growing at a rate 5 times faster than the non-Aboriginal population, and that they're very optimistic about the future, well, they obviously need financial services. And if access to capital is an issue, I think financial institutions and Aboriginal capital corporations can be creative as to what they can do in order to provide that. If you're an Aboriginal entrepreneur, this study is very valuable because it identifies particular keys to success. One thing that we did notice is that those businesses that actually did annual business planning, and it's tough to do that if you're a small business and there's only one or two employees, but we really encourage businesses to kind of lay that out every year, figure out what your goals are and how do you measure yourself against those goals. If you do that type of planning, then there's a higher probability of success. So our survey actually established that, and as well as the need for mentorship. And Aboriginal businesses tend to operate in isolation of one another. Oftentimes they haven't necessarily come from a sort of a family or an environment of longstanding entrepreneurs, and so trying to get that guidance and support and advice as to how do they avoid certain pitfalls in business, well, a mentor can provide that. So I think there's real value for a multitude of different stakeholders for this research.
That was Clint Davis, President and CEO of the Canadian Council for Aboriginal Business. Now here's Kimberly Dawn with One from her CD, Healing Jane. There's a cool project going on in Vancouver. It's a public arts project which combines an electronic billboard and something like tweeting. The project, commissioned by the City of Vancouver, is called Digital Natives and is co-curated by Clint Burnham, an English professor at Simon Fraser University. Clint tells us about the project.
This is a public art project that is funded by the City of Vancouver for its 125th anniversary. And what we've done is we've taken Twitter-like messages and put them up onto an electronic billboard that's next to the Burrard Street Bridge here in Vancouver.
Okay, and what sorts of things are you putting on that electronic billboard?
We solicited contributions from 30 writers and artists, native and non-native, from around North America. And so some of the messages are about the bridge itself or about its location. Some of them are the sign itself is on Squamish territory. A lot of them are about First Nations issues and issues of language and so on.
And so what sort of messages have been going up? Can you tell us some of them?
Sure. I'll just sort of look right now at some of the ones that are coming up on our blog and that. But say distance is not an evil of communication, it is a necessary condition, and that's from a philosopher named Jacques Rancière. So that's the idea of distance and communication. On the first day of class, a boy left a bar of soap on her desk. With sadness, she remembers his name and brand of soap, Indian Act, and that comes from First Nations artist Sunny Asu, A-S-S-U, so it's about the past and about the Indian Act. And that also gets translated into Squamish and into French. Another message, a bit more of a contentious one from the here's a good one from Aboriginal youth. As Aboriginal youth, we need to honor our ancestors and their struggles, focus more on our languages, healthy lifestyles, equal stable families. And that came out of a workshop I did with urban Aboriginal youth here in Vancouver. A final one, and this is an interesting thing, is that some of these have actually been censored by Astral Media. This is from the renowned American Indian artist Edgar Heap of Birds, and it's pretty contentious. It says, Imperial Canada awarded sex abuse to Native youth by the black robes, now proudly bestowed bronze, silver, gold medals with Indian image. So that's a huge one about the whole residential schools legacy and that, and how, but then also at the same time, we have that in our history, but then we use Native imagery as a for touristic reasons, the Olympics, the Inukshuk, all those kinds of things. And so that was too hot for Astral Media, and they're refusing to run it.
Well, that's too bad.
Yeah, I mean, and over the past week, there's been some interesting kind of blowback from the first of all, they didn't want to run any of, we had messages translated into Kwakwala and Squamish, both West Coast native languages, and we're also getting them translated into Musqueam, and they didn't want to run any of those. There's another message that sort of refers to road rage, but also unceded native territory. They won't run that one. So it's an interesting kind of contradiction because the sign is on native land, and the Squamish Nation has been very supportive, very much in our court and that, but also saying to Astral, this is between you and your client, in the same way Squamish Nation isn't involved when they take ads from Guinness or for wine or for Air Canada. We're buying based on the sign from Astral Media. So it's, I think the message that I think that comes out of that kind of censorship, on the one hand, is how difficult, how fragile public language and public space, but also how there's still this kind of, kind of colonization of Native culture and Native language sort of ongoing. And just, one statistic that Deborah Jacobs from the Squamish Nation passed on to me is that there are only 15 living, highly proficient speakers of the Squamish language. And so that's why we think it's all the more important to get these languages, even if people can't read them, up in public space so people are thinking about these issues.
And Clint, how did you come up with this idea?
Well, the bridge it goes over the area, the downtown area of Vancouver called False Creek. And I was just out for a run one day around that area when the sign had just come up. I think it came up in December 2009, so just before the Olympics, like in January 2010, I went for a run, and I saw the sign, and I used Twitter and social media like Facebook in my teaching. I teach English at Simon Fraser, and so I'm very aware of how young people use it and think about that, and I also use it on an everyday sort of basis, so I thought, well, why not electronic media? Why not put a Twitter feed up on this sign? It seemed so easy at the time. And then 15 months later, I met with my co-curator, Lorna Brown. We worked together before. We brought it to this group that does public art projects in Vancouver called Other Sites for Artists. And then we started building funding, first from the Canada Council and then getting a major commission from the City of Vancouver.
Very cool. And how long is the project? When did it start and when does it wrap?
It began yesterday, April the 4th, and it runs until the end of April, April 30th, and then we're having a wrap-up sort of symposium about what's happened in that May the 1st at the Museum of Anthropology.
That was Clint Burnham, English professor at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver and co-curator of the Digital Natives Public Arts Project. Laurentian University in Sudbury claims to be the first university to offer a dual credit program for Aboriginal high school students. This past year, the university offered two courses up for grabs, a business course and a Native social welfare class. It's something that a number of colleges have been doing to boost retention and graduation rates. Peter Luke is the Dean of Faculty Management and helped get the dual credit business program off the ground.
It's a program for Aboriginal high school students to Laurentian, taking a number of courses. In my case, an entrepreneurship related kind of business course, combining theories, basically the practical aspect of that too. So to provide them with an experience at a university setting, and to encourage them to come to universities after they graduate from high schools. And it's taught by a full-time professor, it's supported wholeheartedly by the university and my faculty and myself. And our part of it, the entrepreneurship course, is supported and sponsored in a sense by the Paul Martin Education Initiative. Tremendous support from his foundation, and the person that worked for him comes from Thunder Bay and who coordinates this whole thing along with Sheila, Associate President of Aboriginal Programs.
Okay, and you were saying that you did get 7 students from the Catholic and Rainbow School Boards for the program, and that you also said that the program was quite successful. And can you tell me how you measured that success for the program?
Yeah. I measure it by the end product. I visited them in between, of course. But basically, I witnessed some very professional presentations that is academically sound. Not only that, it's practically sound, too. Some very exciting ideas. And anyone that witnessed those sets of presentations, it was towards the end of January, would agree with me. It's been a huge success. There are a lot of excitement and a lot of learning. And not only that, some real projects are coming out of this. So that's how I measure that.
And were the students mentored in any way with business people in the local community?
Yes. I'm working on it, and we need to time it better next time. It was a pilot project, and by the time we get some of the people excited, local business people through my connection with the Chamber of Commerce, so possibly next year we need to do a better job in terms of the timing of it for the second cohort, so that not only that getting people who are willing, but to allow them to actually do it from a timing perspective, so it will be done. Not just the mentorship aspects, I'm also seeking their support, if at all possible, to help us a bit in terms of the finances, because each of these students are provided $500 for their business plan, and so any additional money would really be helpful.
That was Peter Luke, Dean of the Faculty of Management at Laurentian University in Sudbury. And Vanessa Lewis is a 16-year-old high school student in Sudbury who participated in both dual credit programs.
My experience with the program has been very beneficial towards my future. My teacher, Jennifer Patagus, who is a teacher at St. Charles, a part of the Sudbury District Catholic School Board, she was the one who introduced me to this program. Not only did she introduce me to it, she also helped me along the way with whatever I needed assistance with. She was there for me. The program has helped me with multiple things, whether it's patience with dealing with different people, or learning with different people, different aspects of why they are not succeeding in life as others are. And for the business program, my professor was amazing. Jean-Charles Cachon, he made sure that we learned everything possible and were left with no questions. And in the end, it was very successful and presented our business programs.
So, yeah, and about that, I was talking to Dr. Luke earlier today, and he was talking about those presentations. What was your presentation on?
My presentation was on Lingerie, which is my little pilot business that I am hoping to pursue in the near future. I currently make lingerie products and it's bringing, my quote is, bringing some glam to the world of lingerie.
Very cool. And Native social welfare and business seems like two worlds apart. And why did you take both of those programs?
At one point, they do seem like two different worlds apart. But when you look at it, social welfare is teaching you how different people and why they're in certain circumstances. So this assists me in helping to deal with different people who I would be dealing with in my business world.
Okay, and so you got the credits for school and, well, for high school as well as for Laurentian. And what are your future plans? Are you going to seek education at Laurentian, or what are you going to do?
My future plans would be to most likely attend college first for 2 years, I'd say, and then transfer to university to get my degree.
In?
Business commerce program, along with a fashion degree, hopefully from LaSalle to Montreal.
So which of those programs did you take first?
Last semester, which was running from February to June, I took the Native Social Welfare program, which I enjoyed very much, with Christine Rigo.
Okay. And so they told you about the business program, or what kind of interest did you have in that?
The business program was introduced to me by my school, the Sudbury District Catholic School Board. I was brought to Laurentian University to meet Paul Martin and to exchange in a group discussion. And through that was when I had searched prior to this about the business program, but this is when I decided I really want to pursue this program, when I got to meet Paul Martin and talk to him about that, be interviewed by multiple radio stations and television broadcasting.
So is that what prompted you to take the business program? Did you already have your idea for your lingerie shop before that and for fashion?
I've had my idea for fashion probably since I was six. It's always been like a dream for me, whether it's wedding dresses, I was sewing them for my Barbies when I was really young, till now when I'm sewing my own swimsuits or whatever I want. And whether it's baby booties, crocheting, and I think I've covered a lot of it. It's just something that I have in me, I guess. Okay. I really much so enjoy it.
That was 16-year-old Sudbury High School student Vanessa Lewis. Now here's Money is the Goal by Sandy Schofield.
Then that you will see.
The show must go on, as the saying goes, and it did in Poundmaker First Nation, despite a motion from the band council banning the play Antigone. The play is an Aboriginal adaptation of the classic Greek tragedy, which is set on a contemporary First Nation ruled by a corrupt chief. Deanne Casocchio is the playwright of the modern version and also a member of Poundmaker First Nation.
They banned it 2 days before the performance was supposed to open in Poundmaker.
And why was that?
Apparently the chief had thought that the play Antigone, which was written, the original Antigone was written 2,500 years ago by Sophocles, which I adapted into First Nations contemporary life. He figured that the play was about him because there's a corrupt chief involved.
Wow. I don't know what to say about that.
Yeah, well, I guess he thought that I just wrote the play recently, but this play was actually written back in 1998 and performed at the Globe Theater in 98. So it's a pretty old play. We just revived it, and I guess the issues that are involved are more relevant today because I guess there's, a lot of, I guess, allegations of mismanagement of funds and things like that are public now because of the media. And Antigone kind of touches on some controversial issues within First Nations governance.
And I also understand from reading a story on Post Media News that you're also a member of Poundmaker?
Yes, I am.
And other than having the play banned, did you receive any other backlash being a band member and having that play there?
I haven't received any kind of backlash as of yet. However, community members are, because of the repercussions that happens within communities when you voice out or have, you know, when you voice out against leadership, there are repercussions that happen. But I don't rely, those are people who are scared, the community members that are scared that rely on the reserve, I guess. And I don't have to rely on the reserve at all. I don't work there. I just live there.
Okay. And I understand that the play did go on. And where did the play take place?
The play took place at the local school gym at Chief Poundmaker School. We were locked out of the band hall. The chief did lock us out of there, and so we just moved our show over to the school with one of the band counselors' permission. He supported our show, Counselor Vernon Antoine. He supported what we were doing, so he wanted us to succeed, and he opened up the gym for us, so we had a venue.
Cool. And so about how many people attended?
There was about 60. Most of them were off reserve. They weren't from the reserve. They were from other areas.
Okay, and so I guess that's it for me. Is there anything else you'd like to say or add about the play or the venue that happened in the community?
Well, all I'd like to say is that, there's a good message in the play, and I guess the message is that we as First Nations people have to at least stop and take a look at how our governance structures are set up and what the impact of the Indian Act has had on our governance systems, and that we really need to get back to our values and beliefs as First Nations people and reconsider our way of governing.
That was Deanne Casocchio, playwright of an Aboriginal adaptation of classic Greek tragedy Antigone. You've been listening to Bomb Siddah with Jennifer Ashwasage. Bomb Siddah is an Aboriginal news magazine program which includes current affairs, arts and entertainment, and a cross-genre of music from Aboriginal artists. Bomb Siddah means walking together in the Anishinaabe language. Music for the program is courtesy of Burnt Project One. If you have comments or story ideas, visit my website at bombsedah.com. That's B-A-M-O-S-E-D-A. And thanks for listening to Bomb Siddah.